I'll be giving out those numbers again in about a half an hour when I invite your participation. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, Dee Dee Hubbard, and John Tracy. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lyle.
We'll start a discussion about computer backup in just a moment, but first, the news.
Senators are pushing a new FTC spam proposal. They're calling for aggressive prosecutions of prolific spammers and have touted new proposals that will grant them the FTC, which is Federal Trade Commission, more internet enforcement powers. During a hearing of the Senate Commerce Committee on subcommittee on Wednesday, politicians have expressed frustration over bulk email and pornography on peer-to-peer networks such as Kazaa and Morpheus, and the fact that more and more kids are being they're susceptible to these kinds of images and videos. So it looks like there's going to be a big crackdown. And basically what they want to do is give the FBI broad rights to search databases and basically do whatever they can to crack down on this stuff.
Crack down on spam specifically?
Yeah.
Well, it seems like they'll get a lot of support. I think most people are frustrated with the amount of spam they're getting. I'd be concerned, of course, that lots of times and Congress makes decisions on technology. They're not exactly the right way of doing it. So I think we should keep an eye on that. John?
Let's see. In the world news, we have cell phones being banned. Well, not cell phones, but the camera cell phones. You know, they're really cool. You can take pictures everywhere you go and send them to your friends. One of the problems is in the U.S., major car makers are worried about industrial espionage, people walking in, casually making a call while they're really taking a picture of something, sending that picture to, well, anywhere in the world, and then deleting it so they have no proof that the picture was taken. They've also been banned in some health clubs, especially in the locker rooms. People are worried about things showing up on porn sites, you know, voyeurism and stuff like that. New York district courts have banned them from Broadway plays. Osaka district courts have banned them from a lot of places in and around Tokyo. Different dance venues and plays, movies, things like that. So they're really cool because you can take pictures, but they're starting to be limited in a lot of places because they can take pictures.
You know, small spy camera type things have been around forever. I mean, why is it becoming an issue now?
I think because these are more publicly available. They're really easy to get, and you can use them very casually. They don't have a flash, or you can take pictures without a flash. They don't make a noise when they take pictures if you disable the shutter sound. So people could just think you're making a phone call and you could casually be taking a picture.
And part of the point of having a spy phone is the fact that, or I mean a spy camera, is the fact that you don't know the camera's there. Yeah, I'm sure they would ban spy cameras as well. It's just they don't know that they're there.
Great. Dee Dee, hi, welcome.
Hi.
What's your item for the day?
I just wanted to mention that DVD recordable drive prices are going down, including the combination minus and dash RW. Sorry, minus slash dash, whatever you want to call it, and plus RW, rather.
Both of them. And now, why are they going down? Are the drive costs or the media?
I guess they're just pushing more of them out the door, and production costs have gone down.
Nice. Well, that's good, because we're going to be talking about backup in just a few minutes.
Do we know what how much they're going down?
No. Just they're on the downward
On the downward slope.
Which is great.
I was at Fry's the other day, and yeah, media is ridiculously cheap now. Getting down to, I was seeing stuff for just a few bucks per disc, you know, for a 4.5 gig disc. So,
Sean, Apple's talking about hypertransport. You're the expert on hypertransport. What are they talking about?
Well, nothing has been announced yet. So this is posted on news.com this morning.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it was only a matter of time. Apple has been a founding member of Hypertransport Consortium and has been on, not so active, but has been on the board for, you know, since the inception of the technology. So it's always been questionable what they're going to be using the technology for. AMD uses hypertransport in its new 64-bit Opteron processor and will be using it in their forthcoming Athlon 64 processor, which is due out in the third or fourth quarter of this year. And Transmeta...
Who you work for.
Yeah, who I work for now. also has a processor coming out at the end of the year that'll be using HyperTransport.
And HyperTransport basically is a
it's a high speed, low pin count, low power chip to chip connection.
Okay, so it goes on the motherboard.
So yeah, it's only a foot to 2 feet is typically the length of one of these connections, maximum length. Mm-hmm. So it's a chip to chip connection, but it's very high speed.
So
HyperTransport 1.0 features an aggregate data transfer rate of anywhere from 6.4 gigabytes per second to 12.8 gigabytes per second.
Nice and fast.
So that's the aggregate means, you know, the total bandwidth both ways. So it also has a bunch of other cool features, but it's unclear what Apple's going to be using this technology for. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be using it as a connection to a processor.
Right.
Because IBM would have to do a lot of work on their processor to enable that kind of functionality. But it could be used in other ways. Just to give you an idea, NVIDIA uses HyperTransport and their Inforce chipset, and Xbox uses it as well.
Speaking of Apple in there somewhere. Speaking of Apple, Quark has finally released a Quark version for Mac OS X.
What is Quark?
Quark is a spreadsheet. It's a desktop publishing tool. Used it to do layout for magazines. You can do it for newspapers, things like that. It used to be one of the industry standards. There was Quark Express and there was PageMaker. Those are the two industry standards for that. But they've been holding out on putting it out for OS X, partially because they were not initially in favor of going to OS X, and they didn't think OS X was going to make it. So they held back.
I think OS X made it.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I've heard a lot of people say, well, I'd be switching over to OS X on my machine if Quark was available.
Well, all you folks who have been waiting, and I'm sure, you know, the 70% of Mac users who haven't switched have just been waiting for Quark, so it's time to switch now.
Actually, I've been waiting to switch to OS X when they finally get support for
x86. Yeah, that would be nice.
I mean, it's a great piece of software, but it just needs a good piece of hardware to back it up.
And in English, that means you could take any PC out there and run the Mac OS on it if that happened. But it hasn't happened yet.
And Apple is a hardware company, not a software company.
That's right. And speaking of... Well, not speaking of Microsoft, actually. Didi, what's Microsoft doing lately?
Microsoft is planning on releasing the new Pocket PC 2003 around June 23rd. Well, there'll be lots of other hardware and interesting announcements going on at Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference, as well as Microsoft's own. Do you want to...
Yeah, I want to comment on that. Don't get your hopes up, because Pocket PC 2003 doesn't give you a whole lot of features, aside from better wireless support for both Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. From what I understand, the big revamping of that OS, including all the cool new features and visual technologies that they're going to be building into that, as well as Longhorn, won't come until next year in a version that's codenamed Magneto.
That's great.
Well, speaking of really cool code names. Since Apple is going to start putting out a 64-bit version of their Mac OS X operating system, hopefully in preparation for 64-bit processors to run on, which is the rumor, there's all these internet rumors about Schmeagle, which would be the OS 10.2 Jaguar 64-bit somewhat-enabled.
Are there any 64-bit enabled Macintosh processors at this point?
Not at this point.
So why would they release the operating system?
They would want it to run on new hardware.
Which they haven't released,
but it gives it a really cool name.
Schmeagle's a good name. I'm glad you brought it up.
And of course, for those who don't know, Schmeagle is Gollum's real name in Lord of the Rings.
So Sony is invented a tactile panel for PDAs. It lets you feel and push virtual buttons under the screen, or on the screen. So the screen actually would have a feel to it, a three-dimensional aspect to it.
It
sounds very cool, but it's under development now.
You know, I've seen that in mouses.
In mices?
Yeah, they build tactile feel into mice so that the applications that support
mouses
it.
Mouses was correct.
Yeah, I know.
when you're moving your mouse over the top of a screen and you kind of move off a window, you can actually feel the bump.
But this will
support your finger, which is weird. It'll be interesting to see when you're using a PDA, Sony PDA, exactly what it's going to feel like to push the button.
And 802.11g ratified. But basically,
Cut in half. Yeah, they took 802.11g was a standard that's been pending ratification for a while. Two chip makers, Texas Instrument, I can't remember the other one, Intellios, I think. They were battling it out because they both wanted to support. They both make chips for wireless connectivity. So they'd been kind of battling it out, holding up the standard. Well, it finally got
ratified. Because the two chip designs work differently in the standard. They want the standard to be functioning a little different for both of them, right?
Right.
Okay, so what did they decide to do?
Well, one of the important things about the 802.11g standard is that it's backwards compatible with 802.11b. 802.11b is a wireless standard that's the most prevalent.
It's what Apple's using right now for their airport.
And most of the places you go that have wireless public wireless connectivity points, they use 802.11b. So they wanted to make sure that 802.11g was backwards compatible with it, and in doing so, they dropped it from its promised 54 megabits per second connectivity down to 20 megabits per second connectivity. So if you've got some existing current 802.11g hardware, it'll connect at a faster rate than the next generation that's going to be coming out after the standard's been, now that the standard's been ratified.
Will it be compatible with the standard or not?
It's hit or miss. Who knows?
What a mess.
You know, in the same way that some of the 802.11b devices didn't work with the current 802.11g devices, just because they weren't compatible.
My name's Lyle Troxel. You listen to Geek Speak. The Geeks this morning, Miles, Dee Dee, John, and Sean.
And in the web news, have PNG images are under fire.
What's PNG?
Ping images, sorry. Basically, they are they're an image file format, a compressed image file format. The reason they came into being was that a company called Unisys many years ago stated that the compression used in GIF images, a very popular image format.
People are familiar with web images are JPEGs or GIFs.
Right,
or
they started off on CompuServe forums as a way to transmit images. Basically, people were not okay with every single time they had to write an application that supported GIF, they had to pay Unisys this fee.
Because Unisys owned the algorithm to code.
Okay. And so PNG was born, or ping files were born. The ping standard actually went beyond what GIF could do. They figured, well, if we're going to replace it, we might as well make it better.
Mm-hmm.
So it supports a few things that GIF doesn't. Unfortunately, even though most browsers support it now, IE for Windows has incomplete support for it. You can get it to work correctly, but it...
You have to hack.
Right. Although... It does support out of the box with the same functionality as GIF, but if you use anything that goes beyond that, for example, it allows alpha transparency, in other words, a translucence, being able to have an image there.
A varying degree of translucence.
Right. That is not supported by Microsoft IE, unless you have IE 5.5 or above and use a special CSS hack.
Okay, so what's the news of PNG?
But now, the... patent is running out on GIF, or on the LZW algorithm used in GIF. And so GIF will soon be free, just like every other or major web image format.
Like JPEG, for example.
So it's calling into question whether or not Ping will survive.
Hmm.
Because one of the major browser manufacturers, Internet Explorer for Windows...
still doesn't support it.
Still doesn't support it correctly.
What do you think about this, Miles? Do you want PNG to survive or Ping to survive?
Absolutely. It has features in it. The alpha transparency level alone is...
It would make web development so much easier.
Oh, there's so many times I've wanted to use it, but then had to do some hack for IE, and you have to go through so much extra work for it.
Yeah.
That and GIF only supports 256 colors, right?
Yeah, but then again, you use very few colors on the web anyway. Many times you'll end up with images that are only... eight colors or four colors makes the file size smaller.
You know, one thing I've noticed about PNG is they need to work on file size, because compared to JPEG, it's about anywhere from 6 to 8 times bigger.
Ping files are actually made for GIF images. If you have things that are line art, if they're cartoonish, then that's when you want to use GIF or PNG or a ping file. If you have something that's a continuous tone, like a photograph, that's where you'd use JPEG. And when you make a ping file, Photoshop, for example, has been a culprit where they make large ping files. There are utilities that can shrink it down, same image quality, but will shrink the file size down to below the equivalent GIF.
For the longest time, I thought that PNG was going to be the end-all, be-all. It was going to replace JPEG and GIF, but it's really just replacing
it
GIF
could
and
have.
Adding features.
Internet Explorer 4.0 had initial support for it, and Microsoft pledged that they were going to make it better, and they never did.
Interesting.
If they had, it would have supplanted GIF by now.
By GIF, but not JPEG. It was never designed to supplant JPEG.
Right.
That's what I was trying
right.
to say. Last week, we covered a bit about data recovery. The show is available for download at our website, geekspeak.org. Basically, we learned two important things. One, there are two types of hard drives, those that have failed and those that will. Two, it costs a lot more money to get your data back from a failed hard drive, and the results might not be complete. You need to have copies of your data so that when your hard drive fails, you can get a new hard drive and restore your data. Today on GeekSpeak, data recovery backup.
Or data backup and recovery.
Or data backup and recovery. But specifically, backing up your data so that when you do need to recover, you're ready to do so. We've got a panel of geeks in front of us today, the geeks, Miles, Sean, John, Dee Dee. And we're going to talk about the different platforms and what you need to do to back up your data. Let's start with some Macintosh options and solutions. Dee Dee, where we work at the university, we use an application called Retrospect.
Correct.
What is Retrospect?
Retrospect is a program put out by Dance, which you can have several versions. There's a few levels of personal versions, and then there's a server version. The server version allows one computer to sort of reach out to many other computers, which are running client versions of Retrospect, which the user can sort of tweak and set up, and also set up their system files so that certain files would get backed up onto the main server. So the one server can handle, I think our server currently handles about 25 users a day, and it kind of cycles through them. There are certain people that get backed up all the time because they're up on the scale of importance. But let's see, how many people total?
Well, there's 74 staff we support, and there's actually some faculty. So we're getting up there pretty high in the numbers of people that are being backed up on these tape drive systems.
Yeah, so the server handles the connection to the client, and the data is sent over our high-speed network, which
right.
speeds it up quite a bit because of being on university lines, and mm-hmm. which is really sweet, by the way. and it gets backed up on tape drives, which is kind of out of the reach of the average consumer because the tape drives themselves are rather expensive, and I think each tape is like $30.
So Retrospect, in general, the way we run at the university, for example, is a two-tiered system. We've got a server that has a tape backup system, and then a whole bunch of client machines. Everybody's machine connects to that server, and they interface, transferring the data, and the data gets stored to tape backup.
Right.
And that's kind of actually traditional in the work environment. That's traditionally how it works. You have a server that handles backup, and it interfaces with multiple clients. But that's not necessarily home solution because that gets kind of complicated
right.
for home.
So for your personal backup, Retrospect allows you to back up to, if you had your own tape drive, you could do that, to CDs, various types of CDs, other hard drives, and you could have it on a schedule. It can do incremental backups, meaning that it only takes the changes. And so if you have several backup sets, you don't have to keep backing up your 10 gig hard drive every time, just the little changes.
John, do you want to add to this Macintosh backup possibilities?
There's a couple of cheap freeware utilities out there.
Oh, right. Retrospect is not cheap. Exactly.
Yeah, Retrospect is about $100 for a desktop solution. I think it's a little over $200 for a server solution. And it can be a little overkill. There's a lot of things to set in Retrospect. When you're setting Retrospect up, there's a lot of choices to make. There's a lot of things that can go wrong with the setup on it.
So you'd say that it's kind of for a situation when you have some IT people.
Yeah. For the home user, it can be a little more complex. Unless you've got several machines you want to back up and you want to spend the time to get to know it a little bit. When you get to know it and it's set up properly, it's great.
So what are the free solutions or the cheaper solutions?
There's one called Synchronize Pro, which runs in OS X. It's basically you choose folder A and you choose folder B. Folder A is the folder of information that you want backed up. Folder B is the information where it's going to be backed up to. These can be on separate drives. One can be on a FTP on a website, or it can be a media destination like a CD, whatever. You can schedule it so it'll automatically synchronize between those two folders. One of the things I like about it...
What's it called? Synchronize?
Synchronize with an exclamation mark, Pro.
Okay.
And this is Synchronize Pro 10, well, okay. Pro X.
What one, things do you like about it?
One of the things I like about it over Retrospect, Retrospect, when it backs up the data, it does it in a Retrospect archive format, which means if you want to go grab a file from the Retrospect backup, you can't just browse through the Retrospect file and find it. You have to go into Retrospect and you have to do a restore sequence and find that file in the restore sequence and then restore that file.
And one of the major reasons they do that is for zipping the files. The files are very
compressing,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Retrospect does have really good file compression.
Okay.
One of the things I like about Synchronize for a home user, where you're not so worried about that, is you can go and find that one file and back it up, or the folder and back it up.
And this also seems like a good solution for hard drive backup, where we have an extra hard drive, which we're going to talk about hardware in just a second. I just want to talk a little bit about the software packages, and then we'll get into the hardware you need to actually do backup. Do you want to cover another one?
There's
quickly?
A similar one called, let's see, that's a freeware program. I'm sorry, it's a shareware program. You get to use it for so long, and then you have to pay a $100 fee for it. So there it becomes almost the price of Retrospect. There's another one called Folder Synchronizer, which is nice also, but it's not quite as full-featured, and you can't automate it like you can...
You have to run it yourself?
Yeah. Sorry, if I'm halting here, it's because I was trying to run it, and it launched OS, OS 9 for some reason.
Uh-huh. Well, that's not good.
Folder Synchronizer. Here, let me pull up the info.
Well, you basically have to run it yourself whenever you want to do a folder synchronization.
Right.
I do like the idea of folder synchronization. Of course, if you're doing folder synchronization, you could theoretically say, well, this hard drive has the master, and the other one's just a copy. So I'll just keep on copying and copy the master, and every once in a while I'll delete my older copies of the older one. So Right. You can do that kind of manual process anyway.
Well, and you can set one or the other to master.
Right.
So you can say this one's the master. Another
That's
one's
good
the master.
To know.
And then there's different types. Instead of you can do a synchronization, or you can do just a backup, copy everything over.
Right. Okay. Well, let's jump into the... Oh, Didi, you have an issue?
Well, Apple also offers through .Mac, which is a pay service, which gives you email and storage space and a website. You can also use backup.app, which is Apple's solution, which integrates with iSync and all of that. So it would save your bookmarks, your contacts in your address book. And
but it only works with .Mac?
Yeah. It only works with .Mac.
So you have to be a .Mac subscriber to use it.
That's unfortunate. And, of course, you have to have good bandwidth to save it up to .Mac.
Yeah.
Yikes. Didi, were you saying also?
And since OS 10, if you're using OS 10, which is the current Mac OS, it's also based on Unix. So a lot of the utilities for backup that would work on any NIX would also work on OS 10.
Oh, well, that's good to know. Well, that's a good segue into Unix and Linux backup solutions. Miles, you want to cover this a little bit with us?
Yeah, unfortunately, I have to admit I am horrible with regards to backing up my system. There are some aspects to Linux backup that are easier than some other operating systems. But with regards to applications, unfortunately, I haven't seen anything that was tremendously easy.
Wait a minute. Is the GeekSpeak server getting backed up?
Well, I could see the thing.
Double.
That's
double.
A no.
Well, no, there are copies of the files in other places. So in that sense, there is. But
this is actually
Sean,
a good
everything
point.
Everything that I put up on the GeekSpeak server, I have a local copy of.
But see, this is actually a good point. One of the things that happens when you're backing up and you don't have a backup plan or an application that handles it, you end up with a stack of zip disks or a stack of CDs that you're looking through going, where is that thing? I don't know. It's in here somewhere.
Yeah.
So therefore, you know what? Having an application actually can save you a lot of hassle.
Yeah, as I play with Linux, what I find is we're in the server realm, and that has different requirements than when you're backing up a desktop machine.
Uh-huh.
For example, when you're running a mail server or a database, the mail server is constantly having files come in, rerouting mail around, having queue files, and when you're backing up, you don't want to have a file descriptor open and writing to it while you're trying to back it up.
So how do you back up a mail system that's live?
It depends. Some mail systems are more amenable to it. that they can, they are a bit better with regards to their file handling. Then you also have just, there are times when you just say, okay, I'm going to shut down my mail client or my mail server for 5 minutes as I back up the files to it.
What about for a database where, how do you back up a database if it's the same issue?
Databases, many times, if you want the database, if you stop the database, you can back it up just fine. If the database is live, you'll need facilities that are in the database for backing up a live database, which are going to be different than just backing up the files in the file system the database is using, because databases keep a lot of data in memory, and they won't necessarily have written to the file system. So when you have things like Oracle or Sybase or PostgreSQL, they have live backup utilities. So they'll back up the contents of the database to a file, then you back up that file.
Okay. So and normally your database administrator has a backup process for at least getting a copy that's good, and then you can do the traditional backup on that that good copy.
And also various Unixes and Unix clones, for example, AIX and Linux, you'll have something called the Logical Volume Manager. And what this will do is it detaches your sense of what your disks are, what your drives are, what your directories are, from the actual physical layer of the drives. In other words,
how does that help in data backup?
Because it allows you to do what's called snapshotting. What it allows you to do is, at any particular moment in time, you can say, all right, I want the file system at this moment, and it'll make a backup of that, or make a file of that, and then you can back up that file to whatever your media is, whether it be a tape or a CD. Yeah, and you don't have to worry about whether the file is going to get altered or not, because it's a snapshot. The file, it's a snapshot in time. It's never going to be altered while you're backing it up.
We'll continue our discussion in backup. We're going to cover software solutions for the Windows environment and then also hardware solutions in just a moment. This program is supported by a grant from Cruzeo, providing internet services, including DSL and spam filters, for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruzeo membership is available online at cruzeo.com or by calling 459-6301. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks John, Miles, Sean, and Didi. We're talking about data backup. We invite your questions and comments about data backup problems or questions in general. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You're also welcome to email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue or online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. If you have questions or comments about data backup, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, email geeks@geekspeak.org. Miles, you had points?
And also, this is getting back to Linux being very much a server-oriented operating system. It has a facility called cron.
Okay.
And cron is a scheduler. Allows you to say, at this moment in time, do this, or every 5 minutes, or every day, or every week, do something. And this actually helps out with regards to backups, that you can actually automate that process to make a file in a particular area. And when you don't, if you're not doing something to tape, you know, something that you have to replace constantly, or a CD, for example, if you have, if you're backing up either workstations or smaller servers onto a large server that has a large hard drive array or the like, what you can do is mount it over file sharing, like, for example, NFS, and save the backups to that drive. In that case, it ends up being very automated, where each server is backing up its files to that central server, and the server, you just have a single backup routine.
And so we could be doing that on GeekSpeak server.
Yeah, that, or we could, since a few of us have DSL, that we could have it so that the server is backed up at one of our homes, and our home server is backed up at the GeekSpeak server, so you never have all the information in one location.
It sounds like we're going to need to get more hard drives. Sean,
hi. How come my name always comes up when it comes to hard drives?
I don't know why is that. Sean, Windows environment, what backup solutions are there? What do you do for backup?
Well, you know, before you go out and spend money on a backup solution, Windows 2000, Windows XP, yeah, I couldn't verify of 98, although that's really not supported anymore. So.
Well, it does.
They have backup built into them. And to access it, all you need to do is go to your start button, go to Program, Accessories, and then System Tools, and you'll see Backup. And with that version of Backup, on Windows 2000, it's not as robust as XP. You can pretty much, it gives you the choice to back up everything, lets you select files, drives, network data that you want backed up, or you can just back up the system data, the system state data, which is good for making sure that you get your Windows directory, because a lot of that stuff is running in memory. So you need it needs to back up the stuff that's also running, or you're not going to have a complete backup. In Windows XP, though, they have more selections, such as things that you might want to have backed up are your My Documents folder, your favorites, your desktop, stuff on your desktop, and your cookies. I know cookies have a bad
reputation
reputation associated with them, but the fact is when you go to some websites where you put your name in and password, I mean, if you don't remember that, then you need the cookie, or next time you go back there, you'll need to know that information. And there are other things that you can back up, but the bottom line is Windows has this the basic backup functionality built into it, and it's before you start looking for another solution, more robust solution, because there certainly are more robust solutions than Windows XP or Windows Backup, know that you can back up to pretty much any removable drive, CDR. I'm not quite sure about DVD recordable. I haven't tested that myself. Hard drive, network share, and you can even append to that backup, which means that you don't need to back up all your data all the time. I mean, that would really eat up disk space. Any good backup application is going to give you an append feature, which allows you to just add those files that have changed to the existing backup area. But the bottom line is to do a good backup, because you're never just going to do this on your own. We're always busy. Right. You need to schedule something to do it for you.
Okay, are you backing up currently, Sean?
I back up the DVD.
Okay, you back up your important documents?
My important documents, mostly my pictures and my articles.
We're going to take a quick break from backup to answer Jewel's question. Jewel, where are you calling from?
Oh, hi, I'm Santa Cruz in a car.
Hi, what's your question?
I don't really understand why alpha transparency is a good thing to have for my web pictures. What is it exactly? I mean, I've got Adobe. I heard you talking about it at the beginning of the show.
Yes.
About JPEGs and pings and that
sure.
stuff. What makes, why is it better? What does it do exactly?
For your web photos, like if you're taking photographs, there's not really a need for it. But alpha transparencies are more for like logos and things of that nature, where you have a background color. You know how you can set your background of a web document? And then you put a logo in front of that. And the logo, let's say you don't want it to be just a box. You want the logo to actually look like it's integrated into the site.
Sure.
So you'd want to make the background of that logo be the same color as that page. Therefore, you wouldn't need any alpha transparency. But let's say you put that logo in multiple places. You put it on a background of a blue, and you put it on a background of a red. And the logo should look okay, but you have to have the background of that image actually match the page. Well, instead, you just have an alpha transparency where that section is transparent, and anything you put it over, it blends in nicely to that page. Miles, want to add to that?
Yeah, also when you have drop shadows on an image. For example, a lot of times when people have image galleries, they'll want to put a drop shadow behind it. If the drop shadow is an alpha transparency, that means it doesn't matter what the background is. It can simply put the drop shadow on top of a blue, on top
of a
red.
It's like a real shadow where the shadow, the darkness actually affects the thing behind it, rather than saying, well, this is black fading into red, which wouldn't work on a blue background.
Oh, I've done that by accident with that that feature, but I didn't really understand what was going on. Oh, great.
You know,
I get it.
Thanks for the
call. We should clarify this because GIF supports transparency, but it doesn't support at many levels.
Right. It's called a one-bit transparency. It's either transparent or it's opaque.
So if you take an image oftentimes and put a transparency on the background of that image, you'll get these jaggies around it.
When you put it on a different color.
When you put it on a different color. And that's because it doesn't support all the different variants of that color from the edge of that picture down to the background. Kind of hard to do.
Thank you, Jewel, for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
It is interesting trying to describe image stuff over the radio. I love it.
Yeah.
We also have a call from Pamela of Santa Cruz Mountains. Pamela, where in the Santa Cruz Mountains are you calling from?
Off of Highway 17, about in the middle, right, a little around the summit.
Okay. What's your question?
My question is, I'm backing up my important files, specifically Quicken and tax data, onto a portable CDRW drive. And this, I'm finding something kind of strange that I don't understand, and it may be very basic, and that is that if I back up onto a CDRW, Quicken can read that file with no problem. But if I back up onto a CDR disk, Quicken says it can't read it. Is that to be expected, or is there something funny going on?
I wonder if it's because it's locked.
Yeah, just because the files can't be written to. Because I believe when you open up a Quicken file, Quicken wants to write back to it.
All you have to do, you can go ahead and you can back up to a CDR, and then when you want to access that file again from Quicken, you have to open it up and then copy it to your back to a hard drive or someplace that's mutable.
Ah.
Right. If you copied it back to your hard drive, and you might need to change the read-only bit on it.
Maybe.
Possibly, yeah.
Which means do a properties on that file, and then unclick the read-only.
You could always try using a CDR media and then just use packet writing, because that will act in with some software as though it's just a floppy. It would act as though it's read-write media.
That's true. You could
do
that.
That
might simplify it. Using CDRW instead of CDR.
Well, that's what she was using, CDRW, and it was working.
Okay.
So that's how it was working, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only problem is I have two whole boxes of CDRs.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, just you can back up, just copy back to your hard drive and use it.
The other thing you could do is, I mean, I'm assuming you're just backing up every time you finish Quicken, right?
Not every time, but...
Sometimes. Yeah. Yeah, what you can also do, if you have trouble with doing a CD, you can go ahead and back up to your hard drive, your normal hard drive, and then copy that file over using a CD writing software. That's more complex, but that's technically what the application's doing. So in any case...
Yeah, that was actually what I did the first time I was using Nero.
Uh-huh, right, exactly. But it is easier to do it in the application. And so try that. Assuming that you already have a CDR that it actually wrote the backup to, copy that backup now onto your machine and see if you can access it with Quicken.
Yeah,
and if you can, then you know it's a good backup and it's okay even though it doesn't read it afterwards.
Good suggestion. I hadn't thought about the fact that Quicken thinks that it's going to need to write. So
yeah,
thank you.
Thank you very much, Pamela.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. If you'd like to join GeekSpeak, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're also available at geeks@geekspeak.org. Sean, we were talking about software solutions for the Windows environment. You talked a little bit about Windows has a built-in thing that does backup, and it works pretty well. What about suites that do scheduled stuff for you?
There are a couple of pieces of software. In fact, we have them. Wanted to get them written up by the show today, but we didn't have a chance to. So in the next week or two, check out geekspeak.org, and we'll have full reviews up. One of them is from Stomp Incorporated. It's called Backup My PC. Which is formerly Backup Exec Desktop by Veritas. And the other is Backup Now Deluxe 3.0 from NTI. Both offer you more robust backup solutions. I think the biggest feature that you can get with these is the ability to create bootable DVDs and CDs with your image. So let's say you turn on your computer, it doesn't turn on, and you realize it's your hard drive, it's crashed or is inaccessible. Well, with this, you could actually go buy a new hard drive, slap it into your computer, boot off the CDs or DVDs that you made, and it'll even span those when you actually create your backup. So you could have a stack of these things, depending on how much data you have, and it'll put your system right back where it was when you backed it up.
So you boot from the CD, and it just starts the process of making the drive back again. Well, that sounds like a really easy way to do it. Is that process, though, time-consuming?
Well, it's only time-consuming when you're creating the backup.
Okay.
And if it's more data than the CD or DVD can hold, you need to be on hand to put in new media.
So a clean way to do it would be back up like once a month your entire system. And then as you're going along with files, you could have that on a second drive or on a just burning CD or maybe a floppy even if they're smaller.
I find that if you when you install Windows, create two separate partitions.
An option when you're installing Windows?
It is.
Okay.
Create a C partition and then save space to create a D partition. And when you're installing Windows, you boot off the CD. You can choose how big you want your Windows partition to be.
Sure.
Just make it smaller, and then when you get into Windows, you can actually go in and create a second partition on that extra space.
Now, why
you want that? You want to keep your data on that second partition outside of the Windows data. and you want to install your applications in the C drive, in the first partition where Windows resides. So what that does is it separates all the data that you can easily reinstall that you don't need to back up.
Like applications.
Like applications and Windows files and whatnot. And it separates that from your data, your personal data, which is on your second partition.
But it's also some of your personal data is going to be put in My Documents, which is going to be on C drive.
So yeah, you need to be careful when you save your data. And oftentimes, it'll pretty much default to your My Documents directory. Mm-hmm. And, of course, your favorites, those websites that you like to go to often that you save, are going to be on your C drive. And
in the My Documents.
In your
well,
My Documents folder. And other information is going to be there.
Dee Dee, you have a question or issue?
There are some freeware utilities that have been around since, I guess, Windows 98 Power Tools and Tweak UI, which allow you to adjust where Windows believes your My Documents and other folders are. So once you had your data on your separate partition, you could specify that My Documents are going to go on that second partition rather than the first.
Yeah, that's a really good piece of information.
Jack, you're on GeekSpeak.
Great. I walked out of the room and came back in. I hope this isn't redundant, but concerning the CDRW backup, is there a program that allows me to look at it like a zip drive on my desktop, or what's the best software to deal with that on a Mac?
You mean for writing purposes, having it just write and read?
Yeah, for, you know, backup that I can, you know, keep going back over it.
Oh, well, CDs are not the best technology in general for, you know, erasing it and keep on writing to it. What has to happen when you want to erase a CDRW is you actually have to erase the entire thing. Oh, Miles is saying
but
no.
Not with some packet writing technology.
Yeah, but also understand you're not writing over your data.
Right, you keep on appending to it.
You're appending to it, and it's just updating the directory structure on the disk.
Okay.
So it's not really like a zip. Now, there are some software that does that on a Windows environment where it looks like you keep on writing on it, but really what's happening is if you wrote the same file, which was pretty small, over and over again, the CD is actually filling up with the multiple copies of it. You only see the last package.
Yeah, it's more
that's
complicated.
That's why nobody uses them.
That's basically why they're not used like a zip drive, and they're not really for that purpose.
Okay.
Also, you'll find that if you don't use CDRW, your media is much cheaper. CDRs are pretty inexpensive. They're like 30 cents a piece versus CDRWs, which can be up in the $2 range.
They're actually getting cheaper. I was actually seeing them for less than $1 per disc.
Well, so they're getting closer. I mean, I personally really when I first got my CDR. Drive. I really wanted the CDRW media because then you could keep on reusing it. But then I found that I just keep on making discs.
Yeah.
New discs.
Yeah, CDRW media is more expensive. It's slower to write to CDRW than to CDR.
Yeah.
Lately, to be honest, I've been having the exact opposite effect. I've been having so many of these CDRs just lying around of media that I don't need anymore. I'm now getting to the point where I just want to get a CDR disc and use just 5 over and over again for all those quick little jobs I would have used a CDR for in the past. Just have a CDRW and just wipe it, write it again, wipe it, write it again, try something new.
Michael, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yes, I have a question, and maybe it's related to this. My son was trying to burn a CD. He's done it before, and I got him some CDs, and the first two songs burn, and then it says error, and then you can't burn over those again.
Right. The CDs will get, if you ever run into a CD burning error, the CD recorded media is pretty much useless. You throw it away. So you really want to try to avoid the errors. Now, what application are you using?
He's got a Dell computer.
Okay.
It's a couple years old, and it came with a CD burner. He's burned CDs before, but all of a sudden, this error started happening.
Is the software you're using called, help me out.
Some Easy CD Creator.
Is it Easy CD Creator? Do you know?
Not sure. I think it does say, it says create CD on the thing, icon.
That's fine. We're trying to find out the software for...
Well, that's Easy CD.
It's Easy CD Creator. Okay. So Easy CD Creator, if it runs into an error, it's gonna stop writing. Is this on one specific CD that you're trying to copy?
Yes.
It might have scratches.
It could be that the CD is actually not readable perfectly. When you play it, is it okay?
Yes.
The original?
Yes.
You can go. I think you can go and see Easy CD Creator and say skip errors. Anybody know about that? John, Sean, do you know if you can, in Easy CD Creator, if you can skip errors?
I think it depends on your version.
Yeah.
I don't use Easy CD Creator personally.
Yeah. You could try to upgrade EZC Degrader as well, the newer software. I would go ahead and start looking into the preferences, the options in EZC Degrader and the application itself, and see if you can say skip errors. But what that will cause is the output CD will actually have little clips in the sound.
Also, there should be an option for writing a CD image instead of writing that to the hard drive, because then you're not writing directly to the media. You don't have to worry about whether or not the buffer is full.
That's
or not.
A really good idea.
So
make
if you write it to the hard drive first, then if you have errors, then the worst that happens is you have to delete a file off your hard drive. And even if it goes slowly and it has to do some error correction, it can still write it. And then once you have the image, although the image is fairly large, on your hard drive, then you can burn that image directly to your CD without
so
any problem.
So what's happening, Michael, is you want to, instead of copying the CDs directly, you want to say burn, make image of the CD onto your drive. Dee Dee?
For people who have access to the internet, there's this program that I can't recommend any more highly, Exact Audio Copy. It will do as many passes as it can, or until ad nauseum, to try to get all of the audio data off of your CDs that you're trying to either make MP3s of or CD copies of. So
it makes really good image.
Yeah, and it's got an easy setup and also a more advanced setup, so it can go at your pace.
Remember
what was that?
Exact Audio Copy.
That's a website?
That'd be an application. You'd want to go to Google and search for Exact Audio Copy, and you'd probably find it. Thank you for the call, Michael.
Thank you for the show.
Bear in mind that GeekSpeak and KUSP do not condone copyright violations or anything that you might be doing with any advice that we give you.
Support for this program is brought to you. No, sorry. Let's talk about hardware quickly on backups before we run out of time for the day. We talked about CDRWs quite a bit because it looks like people are using those. There's DVD potential, but we're not really sure how well it works because none of us actually do backups to our stuff. Except for maybe Sean, but not with automated systems. And then there's traditional stuff is tape. Let's talk real quick about tape. Miles, you found some interesting thing about tape backup recently.
I've been looking around recently at shops for tape backup drives. And in the past, it used to be tape drives were so much cheaper than hard drives. The tapes were so much cheaper, and it just made a lot of sense. They were slower than hard drives, but they were so much cheaper, it made sense. Nowadays, I'm finding that tape drives are more expensive than their equivalent hard drives. And tapes aren't making as much sense.
So, example, let's say you want to go in. I've got over 120 gigs of data on my machine, so I want to go get a tape backup. What do I get?
When I was looking at tape solutions that actually saved 120 gigabytes of data, they were running in the $3,000 range.
For the tape drive?
Yeah.
And then how much per tape?
And the tapes were,
$60.
Yeah, up in that range, just... Yeah. You're getting into the range where you might as well just buy another bunch of buy a stack of hard drives.
Well, Dee Dee, how much is a 120 gig hard drive FireWire?
Well, I purchased one about a year ago now, and I got it a pretty good deal on it. I thought it was 120 gigs with the FireWire and USB 2.0, and it was about $299 when I got it.
But okay,
they're now down to $220.
$220 for FireWire enclosure with a 120 gig hard drive.
The only
compared
thing
to the tape backup, if you're trying $3,000 for a tape backup system, you could buy a couple FireWire drives.
Oh, but this has happened to me just recently. What if your backup drive fails?
Right.
Then you're in.
Well,
yeah.
What if your tape media fails?
I think people, if you buy a removable FireWire or USB 2.0 backup hard drive enclosure, you think that, okay, it must be made so that I can carry this around with me everywhere. And the problem is, it's still a hard drive in that. And if you drop that or knock it, you can easily scratch the platters. So it's not as portable as it seems to be.
Right. Well, the reason I was thinking of a FireWire enclosure for a hard drive is that if you're doing a hard drive backup, as our guest last week talked about in data recovery, Ron Austin, he mentioned that if you're going to do a backup, you don't really want the drive in the same physical machine, because what if you have a fire or something?
Yep.
You want to actually get that copy of that data in a physically remote location. You can't do that if you put another internal drive.
Actually, not in the same machine, but in the same house or building.
Of course, you say in the same house or building. But I hear people that have fireproof cases that you can theoretically put stuff in. You could get a FireWire drive and put your FireWire drive inside that case.
Something that's really cool about a lot of these backup solutions is the ability to encrypt the data that you back up and put a password on it. So let's say you have an ISP that's giving you 500 megs of space on their server, but you don't want to put your documents up there because you don't know where the server resides and who has access to it. Well, you could back up this data, encrypt it, and put a password on it, and then copy it up there. and odds are it's probably going to be fine.
And using basically the concept behind Apple's .Mac backup app, which sounds really great because if you're putting it on a server, you know it's remote. And
right.
you don't have to go to the trouble of actually putting on some media and taking over to your grandma's house. I mean, you can have remoteness without... Of course, you have to have bandwidth.
And remoteness is also backing up the CD or DVD or even a FireWire drive and just taking it somewhere else. Have a friend hold on to it for you or...
Okay, so what about...
Security box.
I personally use backup on multiple hard drives. I got multiple hard drives in one box, and I just kind of copy stuff over. And then whenever we do LAN parties, I'll copy it between maybe another machine. Of course, normally people don't want copies of my data, so I'll also do CD or DVD burns. And you said, Sean, you're doing DVD burns?
Yeah.
Miles, what are you doing for backup?
Mostly CD. Every 6 months or so, I'm always wiping out my system and starting over again. So most of the time, I'm just taking a CD and taking the information I want. It usually ends up only being about 100 or 200 megs.
And, John, you were saying you use a FireWire drive, but recently your FireWire drive died.
That's correct.
Conceptually, if you even have only one backup media and you do it regularly, at one point you're going to say, oh, my backup media is dead, so I better find another backup media because my main hard drive is not. So did you have a situation where both fail at the same time?
No, I have a backup drive that I copy my really critical data to, and for some reason I can't read it either right now. So right now I have no backup, but I do have my original data on my laptop, which inherently is a bad place to have all your data. So I'm actually on my way home stopping to get a new hard drive so I can continue backing up.
But the solution did work for you because when you found that your backup was dead, you still had your main machine copy.
Right, and that's because I try to back up once a week. So I'm touching that drive once a week to make sure it's alive.
And that's why it works pretty well. That's why having a second hard drive works pretty well, because when it does fail, your primary is still working.
Right.
And if your primary fails, hopefully your backup's working.
But
risky, but it works pretty well.
One of the points I want to make is a lot of times what happens is you have a backup schedule, or you have a automated backup running in the background, something like Retrospect, where it's going every day and it's doing it, and you're like, great, I'm backing up, sure, I've got my backup right here. The time comes when your hard drive crashes, because that time will come. You have to back up the data. Oops, what do you know? There's this error. The data wasn't really getting backed up, or the media is unreadable, and for some reason it wasn't giving an error, or any number of 100, or I don't know how to restore from this.
Right.
Because all my instructions were online, and that computer's crashed.
And that's crucial to learning a backup software. You've got to try it once. You've got to back it up and then see if you can recover.
Right.
Because if you can't, then you're going to be really in hard
times. That reminds me, with regards to backup media, if you have hard drives or tapes, don't put them close to fans. Don't put them next to speakers. It's magnetic media. If you have CDs, keep them out of direct sunlight. Put them into a closet.
And if you're a small business, you might want to look into storage area networks. Big area now. These are external devices that plug into your network and give you storage capability. Oftentimes, multiple hard drives that are mirrored, which means that when data is copied onto these things, it actually copies that data onto multiple hard drives, so that if one of them fails, you still have your data. So SnapServer.com, they sell those, and a lot of big companies. You go to Fry's or local stores.
One crucial thing, if you are a business, small or large, and you have a backup program going, make sure that you have at least... at minimum, two sets of media, and keep one of those sets of media off-site. If some disaster happens to your office and everything is destroyed, make sure you have a copy of all the data that you would need to get back up and running off-site.
Miles, quickly.
And if you're planning on backing up to DVD, don't skimp. Buy a faster speed DVD drive. It takes a while to write
sure does.
4.9 gigs or 4.8 gigs.
And the faster removable ones. Devices are NAS, network-attached storage.
Network-attached storage. And they're like a system that... is networked, that runs by itself.
Yeah, it's a box that has everything you need. You just plug it into your network, and it's good to go. It's that simple.
Like the good old Snap servers.
Yeah.
This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. The geeks this morning were John Tracy, Sean Cleveland, Dee Dee Hubbard, and Miles Elam. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for participating in Geek Speak.
Oh, you're welcome.
To those of you that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without your input, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? We'll be back next week. We're talking about... John, what are we talking about next week?
We have Paul from the Exploratorium. Paul has a physics degree, and he has been doing this show called Iron Science Chef. No, Iron Science Teacher, based on the Iron Chef
show. So he's going to be coming on talking about that.
How and the Exploratorium and how cool
the
they
exploratorium,
are.
Exploratorium, yes.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Otto. We're on the web at KUSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, and this was Geek Speak. Coming up next, Fine Print.